Welcome, podcast listeners. You are at the Adventure Sling Podcast, the podcast where we speak adventure. Hey, Aaron, how are you?
Hey, I am doing pretty well.
Yeah, been busy working on the stuff.
Yes, all the stuff, absolutely. You know, we've taken a big little shuffle.
Yeah. It has been a big little shuffle. It's been about a month since we closed the door on the initial crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And right. Yeah, I feel like we hit our momentum, you know, we started hitting that momentum kind of right at the end there. And which means, you know, we got a little bit ahead of ourselves, perhaps. Happens.
Yeah, it does, I think.
Yeah. But I'm excited for where we're going as we gear up and start pulling things together to come back.
Absolutely. Yes. We've been doing a lot to, you know, test what we've put together through the gauntlet, as it were, and, you know, restructure maybe our presentation, especially the quick start, which is what I'm really excited about. But yeah, it's looking really good.
Yep. Yeah, revamped quick start to just help everyone, you know, get a foot in the door while we develop the final steps or the final process on the overall system, and also work towards. I think it's going to be a nicer Kickstarter presentation. We took a lot of perspective with us when we walked away this first time, and you know,
absolutely
fall forward.
That's right. We learned a lot, and now we get to apply it.
Yeah, yes, we do. And speaking of understanding progress, forwardness, development, we get to talk to Lewis today about how that stuff works and his experience. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've been working with Lewis for, I started working with him close to the beginning. I think we'll talk about that in just a little bit, but it's been nice to continue to work with him and to watch Dead Channel Studios develop.
Absolutely. I mean, I think he was the first contact and friend I made in the biz, so to speak.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really cool to kind of, you know, see that his watch his progress come along.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we talk to Lewis about it, see what he has to say?
Let's do it.
All right. Lewis, thanks for joining us today. We are glad to have you here. Excited to hear what's going on over at Dead Channel Studios.
I'm happy to be here. Super excited.
Wonderful. Yeah. So you have a company, Dead Channel Studios, right? So if you maybe just give us a slight bit about that, and then we'll get back to it after some background insights.
No worries. So I started Dead Channel Studios roughly about 2 years ago, after I'd been working in the tabletop industry on Carbon 21 and 5 Dragon Tail Games. And I'd learned a lot during my time there and been quite inspired by what I'd done. And I wanted to really do my own work and my own project. So I sort of took the next step and tried to start launching my own Kickstarters, which have been, they've had sort of their, you know, successes and greater successes. And yeah, it's been really good the last 2 years. And I'm looking to obviously do some more interesting things down the line. And Dead Channel Studios has really grown over those 2 years quite nicely. And I'm very happy with the work that I've produced.
Nice. Yeah. It's been fun to watch it grow. Been kind of aware since the beginning myself. So
yeah, well, you guys have like been more involved over time as things have gotten better. For like, obviously, you know, with yourself, Ty, you've been there to help with the editing. Kind of, you helped with that kind of start, so you've seen that full process, and especially with the work I produced from start to where we are now. So you guys have definitely had a big hand in that.
Right. Well, you and I even go back to Carbon with
yes.
Exactly. Oh yeah.
Dragon Turtles now.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. Well, maybe we'll get into that a little bit more, but one of the places we like to start is maybe you can tell us a little about your introduction to tabletop role-playing games.
So I actually got into tabletop games when I was working, I was volunteering at an arcade doing sort of community management stuff and trying to do events and whatnot. And it was a great little thing at the time, like a little fun job to do when I was about 18. And we used to run a card game night because I was really into like Yu-Gi-Oh, Magic, all that kind of stuff. And eventually the guys that I was playing with, we were playing on like these pool tables and we put little coverings over them. And eventually we got into, they showed me fourth edition or 4.5 D&D. And I got into it from there and absolutely fell in love with the game. We'd be playing these massive, pardon me, sorry, 4 3-hour sessions. And, I created this character that was very reminiscent of Nero from Devil May Cry 4. So it shows when I started playing was about then. He was this demon hunter with demon arm and stuff and just had an absolute blast with it and had so many great memories. We thoroughly enjoyed it. Thoroughly, thoroughly. And now I'm absolutely in love with the game. As well as, several other tabletop games now and board games. I just love the experience of people and what they can bring to the table rather than just a computer game, which again, people still bring these really fascinating things to the table. But I think just with that natural, it's all human. So where the error and the successes are all, they're all unique, which I absolutely love.
Right, that simulation of real life in a way,
Yeah.
or reality, I guess.
Exactly.
Fascinating. So essentially fourth edition rules is what you started with.
Pretty much, which a lot of people are very shocked about when they hear.
I mean, it has fourth edition has. Oh, sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say something similar to what I think you're about to say, where fourth edition does have a lot of that controversy. And I've only ever heard one person say something positive about it, but it's definitely, a deviation from the most other systems, I think, in general.
I feel like fourth edition is kind of like the Gen X. As a Gen Xer myself, I feel like our generation is like we're the one that nobody worries about, but we're sort of fans of ourselves, and fourth edition is a fan of itself. And the people that like fourth edition just quietly go about being fourth edition people. Everybody else is out here milling about between 3.5 and fifth edition, or first edition and fifth edition, and so you've got like the boomers against the millennials, whereas fourth edition is just quietly here in its own little bubble, and those that like it, and that's fine for them.
Yeah, I think it's just, it is very interesting, especially with like I know now that for some people, the even ones are the worst ones, and the odd ones seem to be the better ones. Like some people very much like third edition, some people very much don't like second edition. And people seem to love first edition, that classic of the game. So it's very interesting, very interesting when I tell the people that like fourth edition D&D was my introduction to tabletops in general.
Have you ever played first edition?
Good God, no, never.
I think that the draw and the passion for first edition and old school is driven as much by nostalgia, as it is by sadism.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I'm not sure what first is like, but I have my visions of it. And I remember with any game system like that, especially where fifth edition is at now, is if where it's at now, I can't imagine, four iterations back of what it was like before. All the little errors and bits that they would have fixed, even just improving gameplay, just functionality, quality of life. But some people love that. They love that original concept because that's what really gave it a start.
I mean, it's certainly a major point of nostalgia for me because that's where I started. But I can't even remember how it really works, to tell you the truth. So, I'd have to learn it again, I think, to even run it.
It's interesting.
So fourth and fifth edition, those are your points
Main
of,
ones, yeah. Obviously,
yeah.
I like to play Carbon 2185, played loads of that. Massively into Warhammer at the moment. Absolutely love that. I've got Age of Sigmar stuff, but I'm very much in 40K at the moment. I thoroughly enjoy painting. I've always had that kind of artistic flair, both in the writing sense and the sort of physical. I did art in secondary school, graphic design in college, and even at university. Obviously, I have a bachelor degree in computer science of games design.
Oh,
So,
nice.
I've had all those experiences and such. doing those, and you know, especially now with 40k, I love that. So I've got that sort of game that I can, it's all mechanic based, but and I can kind of be creative with how I paint and make those models, which I'd love to get some other models other than 40k ones to do like with D&D stuff, but I never really, because the way you play Warhammer obviously is with all models, then there's very much that need for models, but with D&D you don't always need to do that, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very accessible compared to 40k and Age of Sigmar, Games Workshop, which is a UK company over here. It's very, I don't know if you know the game massively yourselves, but it's expensive to get into. Like,
I've heard that.
And I think that's kind of a pro and a con of it. Like, even I know, I don't even think how much money I've spent on it, but I enjoy it and love it. And, you know, for someone that plays D&D physically, again, that would probably cost a lot of money. But, you know, people play how they play and they enjoy it the way they do.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, our money doesn't do us any good just sitting on the ground in front of our door.
This is the thing. Like, I keep having the conversation about moving out, and especially in the UK and the current economy and the way the world's built, it's just something that it's way smart for me to stay at home. I'm 25 now, which is, you know, it's very common for someone my age to be living with their parents still. And I think I imagine it's a similar case in the US. I know very much there's quite a bit of a housing crisis going over there, not to get too political, but, you know, I have been able to enjoy these hobbies and do these things. And obviously I contribute to my household and just kind of not have that stress of, you know, I do have a part-time job, you know, just to make that extra money on the regular, but I couldn't imagine then doing that full time. Like you say, like we were having a chat before the podcast, we're talking about, you know, quality of mind and giving yourself time. And it's something that they very much do with the work I do. I know that there's a balance between getting stuff done and keeping your mind healthy, because a healthy mind doesn't produce good work.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And and things are, as far as the economy goes, they're quite different in the world than when they may have been a little bit more manageable for previous generations.
You know, 20 years ago, the world was a completely different place.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So,
when the Fire Nation attacked.
You bring up an interesting point, though, real quick, that came to mind with regard to your education and the way that it informs your work in the industry. That's a really nice overlap, I think. It's a question that I actually, because a lot of listeners know that, and you all know that I'm a college teacher, and what I use this question in my critical thinking class: what are some industries where gaming informs job opportunities? And it's surprising to see the students don't often make the connection between writing and editing and marketing and layout. And
I never did. All these skills I have now, when I finished university, I had none of them. To be fair, my writing skills, I'd massively improved my dissertation writing, like, you know, studying. Like, I did a dissertation on the importance of sound and accessibility in video games. So talking about, you know, why sound is such an important thing that's so overlooked. Like, people commend games for their sound, but they don't realize, like in movies, you never really truly appreciate the art of sound. It's such a insane thing. And I always love to watch, like, you know, all those little things. And then I wrote a dissertation about it. But eventually, ironically, I got the job because I went to a funeral, actually, of family friends, and then went to the wake and had a conversation with someone there about their partner who played D&D games and hadn't played in a few years, and I sort of had this craving out of nowhere to play. And a few weeks later I went to the game, and then turns out the person that ran the games was looking for a junior games designer for the company, so got my, you know, CV and portfolio set up for the weekend and sent it across. And I never would have thought that, you know, writing was going to be an option in terms of games design, and I have some very exciting things planned for what I want to do next, which would be nice.
That's awesome. So one of the things I'm curious about is the cultural attitude towards RPGs in the UK, and whether there's any substantial difference that you're aware of between
with the way with the UK, any hobby and stuff like this, you know, any passion or things like that you have, most time it's very much like know of it but don't see it. So it's very much like if you go around places, like, you might find these little shops or stores, like, they are there. But if you don't know where they are, you won't know where to find them. there are loads of people that are into tabletops, board games, you know, and D&D and Warhammer and all that kind of stuff. But it's finding the right people to get into, which, to be fair, can be quite easy. And I've done it myself locally quite a few times. But 9 times out of 10, it's very popular and it's very well known, which is quite nice. And I think compared to the US, UK is sort of so much smaller that it's very easy and more accessible. Like, everyone knows everyone to a degree. So you know that you can always chat to someone, they'll know someone that knows someone. And, you know, it's more of a more closely knit community without being directly connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's part of the perception that some of us have over here. Mm-hmm. Because it is smaller there. Do you ever hear anybody say, oh, you do that weird thing, or that's so nerdy, or that's
satanic? The one that I get is they know it from The Big Bang Theory.
Right.
That's the most common one. I'm like, literally, I had someone who was like, I was like, oh, yeah, I write Adventures for Dungeons and Dragons. Do you know what Dungeons and Dragons is? And then they have that sort of look in their eye where the gears are starting to turn and they're like trying to think of a response. And I go, they're like, I look at them and go, like, you know what it is. And they sort of nod and I'm like, Big Bang Theory? And they're like, Big Bang Theory. Because someone that knows it will just go, oh, yeah, I love D&D. Like, they'll say it. Or, yeah, like, I know what it is. But anyone else that kind of doesn't immediately say, no, I don't know what that is, I've never had any other excuse other than them knowing someone that plays. Like, oh, my partner plays that.
Right. So, let's go back. You started 4th and 5th edition. You've talked about Carbon. And Warhammer. Are there other favorite systems besides D&D, or maybe something obscure?
The Alien tabletop RPG I absolutely love. I haven't got to play a lot of that, but my girlfriend's absolutely in love with it. She wants to play more of those. And I love board games. Like, I just recently played Pandemic for the first time. Lost the first game, won the second one. And I played the Stardew Valley game, which I absolutely love. The board game, not the actual physical game. I've also got the Resident Evil 3 game by Steamforge, which I absolutely loved as well. I really, really enjoy that. And that's kind of, I've taken a big interest into tabletop games like that, like board games where it's this kind of set. It's kind of like a video game, but not a video game sort of thing. Like, the Stardew Valley one's really cool because the idea is you have these objectives you got to do. And then you got the community rooms that you need to do, and you need to do them before the end of the year. Otherwise, you know, the big corporation takes over. And there's different ways that you can make money, and there's these really cool gameplay elements, and, you know, you have to really work together. And it just simplifies the game in a way that it becomes completely different to playing the actual game, which I always love.
I was going to ask, yeah, because Stardew Valley is, you know, I played that on you know, the game itself, I guess. As a board game, I was like, how does that work? That sounds pretty interesting, though.
So, like, to summarize the turn base is, obviously, you flip a season card. Like, we played quite a short game, but the game can last for about 3 hours. And that's really where you get into getting all your crops going, et cetera, and doing all that. So in a turn, you each take a turn, and you have your main phase where, so you, at the start of the turn, before anyone goes, you do your season phase where you flip your season card, and then you have a bunch of things that happen at the start of the season. You might even get a special season card, and that's where you kind of like sell stuff from the day before, etc. And then you have your actual action phase, and you can either perform an action, move, and perform an action, or you can perform an action twice on the same space. So you decide where you're going to at the start of the day. So, like, you can go fishing at one of 3 spots, and that's a little system. You can, like, water crops, you can go buy seeds. And you can only really travel to places that are close to those other places. Kind of like when you're actually playing the game, you only have so much time in the day and so much energy. It's like you have to really kind of think about where you're going and what you're doing. Otherwise, you know, you're going to burn out. So there's only so much you can do. And then when you're there, you can do certain things when you're on those platforms. And then at the end of your turn, you have an end of phase turn where you can, like, build stairways to the next level of the mine. You can upgrade your equipment, and then there's a couple other things you can do. And that's basically how the whole turn kind of goes, and then you rinse and repeat until it's the end of the season, and you've accomplished your goals. Which would be something like, for instance, upgrade each player's starting equipment by 2 levels by the end of the game. And then the community runes would be stuff like you have to get you know, foraged items from spring or whatever. And it's however many players you've got is how many of those items you need to get. So if it's something like, you know, get wood, then you would need to get like 4 wood if you have 4 players and put that into the community room.
Okay.
But then, it would kind of be a team effort on how you do that.
I just want to say this overlap between board games and tabletop RPGs is always fascinating to me because consistently, and I know Aaron is in the camp of the board game fan base, aficionado base,
yeah.
along with role-playing games. Whereas I feel like an outlier a little bit in terms of being really into role-playing games and kind of peripherally familiar with the board game thing. And it might just be because I'm afraid of picking up yet another interest for investment.
I think the two are very much the same, but different in a way. I can see why people could be so into D&D, but not really want to play Monopoly. And the way I see board games and tabletops is that they take place in a cube. With, you know, D&D, you have the cube, and the cube can become anything you want the cube to be. You can add extra cubes on the side. You can take away part of the cube and just make it a flat platform. Like, you can climb on top of the cube, run around the cube, cast a spell at the cube. You have all these infinite possibilities that you can perform with it within the space of the cube in the game. With board games, the cube gives you a set of tools. So you have the cube and you have whatever else that may be inside of it. And that's the tools you kind of have to play the game that it gives you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean so much that you contain, but you have a really specific kind of task and ways that you can do it. Like, we were playing Pandemic, and Pandemic changes up when you play it based on the amount of players you have, the difficulty you play at, the, how well you work as a team and what you do on your turns. Like, the game dramatically changes. Like, we lost our first game playing it yesterday. But we won our second game like so easy, I didn't even realize the game was over. And it just depends on how you use those tools that the game gives you. And I think that's the fun and enticing part of the challenge when it comes to those games.
Yeah, it's also the overlap.
Definitely. So, like, if you love tabletop games, I highly recommend trying a board game. I definitely wouldn't just go for something like Monopoly. Monopoly can be fun. It's a very much game of chance, and there's one strategy that wins all the time. But get something, you know, splash out a bit more. Like, at the end of the day, the amount you spend on D&D, splash out a bit more. Get something like the Resident Evil games by Steam Forge, which are fantastic. That actually has a full campaign. Get yourself the Stardew Valley game. That's awesome. The Dark Souls game is really good, which again, I think is also by Steam Forge, if I'm correct. There's, you know, all those kind of games. And it's worth spending that money because, like D&D, except, well, the difference between that and D&D is that when you buy those things, all that money you're spending, you get so much out of that. Like,
yeah.
Well, it's so worth it.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I mean, yeah, that's a good point. Some of these, like, for instance, I've got Blood Rage, and I think the base game is like $60 or whatever, but it comes with a ton of minis. You know, it comes with much more of its retail value, I think, in miniatures,
which is awesome. Some board games are more worth the money than some video games. Like,
I think I'd happily
pay the same price to get a board game of something that I would an actual physical game. Like, I, for instance, there's something I would love to see a board game of is, and I'm excited for the second game of it, is Rogue Legacy. I played the first one of that, and I would absolutely love to see a board game of that where you have to go in, fight monsters, and just collect loot and do the bosses and just keep rinse and repeating until you finish. I would love that. I love that concept. And that's where I think it goes back to our conversation of people not knowing the options they have when it comes to games design, because those two are the same in every sense. You could take 90% of all video games and you could base them down to a tabletop or board game, which is how they exactly become video games. It's like this infinite loop. And then obviously the alternative is it's literally an idea, and then it's your canvas in which you want that idea to be on, whether you want it to be video format, role play format, you know, card game, board game,
They all offer unique experiences. You know, you play, like you said, like the Stardew Valley, you know, you play the video game And that's much different than the tabletop board game. And I imagine that if you could build a tabletop RPG about Stardew Valley, and it'd still be Stardew Valley RPG, and it'd play different than either one of them.
Yeah, exactly. It's just how do you get that format across, and how do you get that sort of game across, which I think is the really cool part.
Yeah, for sure.
Funny you mentioned the fight the monster, collect the loot, rinse, repeat. That's first edition D&D.
Which I see, I mean, like, all concepts. No, I always say this all the time, even to myself, whenever I make something or I'm going to try and make something. No idea is ever original. Someone's already come up with the idea that you're thinking of, and they've done it. You just might do it better than they did.
Right.
Which is why there's room for more games every year.
Always. Yeah. Always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As much as we're in love with our own product, New of Arden, well, we talk about this, you know, there has to be that point of familiarity as well in order for it to be relatable for a wider audience.
Definitely. I mean, something recently that's been popping up to me is kind of the issues with Kickstarter, which is obviously like the case that, you know, there is a lot of projects out there that do scam people out of their money, which is incredibly horrible. You know, some people will come up with these really cool ideas, but they'll just be concepts so that they can sort of take people's money and then run. And there's then those people like yourself and me that, you know, we want to create these really awesome ideas and, you know, we'll follow through those and update people. But it is a shame that there is just those few projects that tarnish the platform a little bit. And it also doesn't, Kickstarter doesn't do much about it. But as long as people like, you know, us continue to support, deliver, and, you know, especially like to anyone that's looking to do this, go and make a really simple project with a really low budget, make it, send it, give it to people, and then do another one. And those people will come back and you'll start to generate a following. You just have to do it well and do it right. And if people like the stuff, they'll come back.
Yeah. And communicate.
Yeah. Definitely. Communication is so key. Projects that I've backed that very skeptical about. And some people just want to seem to get your money. But for me, I'm like, I raise the target, raise what I can, and then kind of go from there.
So speaking of that, tell us about the current projects at DCS.
So we just funded the Zealots of Anguish, which was a 5e class and adventure trilogy for 5th edition D&D. And it's basically this brand new class because I love spellcasters, but I kind of wanted to create my own iteration of a spellcaster, and it's very much like this interesting new bit of lore that you can throw into your game, and a really cool adventure that has a massive connection to the class. So it's not like the class, the adventure, and the idea are all separate. They're all one unified thing. Not to go too spoiler heavy, but if anyone does want to play, I highly recommend that you skip about 10-20 seconds ahead. But the big ending to the adventure series is that you can make a choice in which you kill all Anguish mages. So if anyone in your party takes that class, you know, it can go very, very, wrong.
I don't know if you played that game. It's a video game of like the two friends who break out of jail together. And then there's a similar spoiler at the ending.
Yes.
I can't remember
the name. I know the one. Yeah, it's great.
Right.
Great game. I started playing with my sister. I need to finish that.
Oh, yeah.
In general terms, then, is that component of it more board game mechanic than RP mechanic, would you say?
No, because at the end of the day, with the adventure and the way I write them is I always write a plan and I write them so that they have a kind of set platform. So for people that want to play them and make them, they can follow that plan. Like, you know, it depends on how skilled the GM is. If they want to follow that rail and kind of try and stick to it, they have that entire plan to follow. But for those people that don't want to do that and do whatever they want, there's nothing stopping them from doing that. What you write on paper isn't what you have to do. And that's the difference between a board game and a tabletop game, like a role-playing game like Dungeons and Dragons, is that you can completely go off the rails and create your own story. Just because what I have written down in front of you doesn't mean that you have to follow that script. It's more of a suggestion, like a yes and. Like, this is where we are taking the story, where I've taken the story as a writer, but you as a player, as a GM, can do whatever you want. Like, it's designed in a way, so in terms of, this is where the mechanics come in, there's a point in the first part that you go up against the quote-unquote big bad, and they are way too high a CR for what you should be fighting. But that's the idea. Whether you are able to get them down to health or whether you're you start to die, you then there's a note in there for the GM to basically take you out of that combat in a way that progresses the story. But as long as you're smart enough, you can make that happen however you want. And then, for instance, there's a section, you know, in part two where you have this kind of sandboxy kind of area in which you need to perform a second game. But at the end of the day, if you want to go ahead and go do A, B, and C in the reverse order, you can go do that. Or if you want to do the B, C, D, A, you can do that. Or if you just want to do A, B, C, D, you have the choice. And that, again, is the difference between a board game and a role-playing game like D&D, is that you have the freedom to do things in the order that you want to do them.
I'd like to go back and look and just discuss this concept of CR, which is a 5e thing in particular, and balance and all that kind of stuff. It's a very interesting thing to me. I remember running first edition games where I didn't worry as much about the difficulty of the creature. I was more focused on how it plays out in the setting. And if and I expected the characters to run away if they started to become overwhelmed. At the same time, I expected that the encounter was going to be exciting and vigorous. And well, robust. 5e is a little bit more nerfy, I think.
It's not nerfy so much as first edition is, I don't know if you've seen it, but the anime Goblin Slayer.
Yes, I have seen that.
This is how I imagine first edition D&D, because I love Goblin Slayer and I love how it's very much like, you know, when even something as simple as a goblin can be incredibly bad, like especially in that first episode, like that is such a horrific scene that the tone of it feels like fifth edition going into first edition. Like I can imagine the meme of, you know, fifth edition player in D&D and then first edition and then that really horrific and sort of grotesque scene. But to a sense of realism, that's what would happen in that world. These horrific and terrifying creatures really are ferocious, and they're not something that you should just take lightly. Like this group of young hired light adventurers are like, oh yeah, let's go kill goblins. They're like the weakest creature ever. And then there's a guy who specializes in killing goblins. He knows how to kill goblins. And I've always wanted to role play as the Goblin Slayer because I absolutely love that series. It's then the other side of it is like 5e very much now is kind of like Gauntlet to a degree. Like the challenge increases as you go on, like the scale of it, but it's designed in a way to give you that continuous progression that you are building up and, you know, you're getting better. Some people want first edition, they like it because there's that really high difficulty and unsure of what really you should be going up against and knowing when to run. 5e is very much that reward of, you know, like the conversation between XP and milestones. It is the thing that we crave of, you know, reward. And it's a very satisfying nature, but I also love, which is why I love board games with that concept of a severe difficulty. Like the Resident Evil board game campaigns are very brutal and there is very little room for error. And especially if you go up against any of the bosses, it's genuinely like playing the game on the hardest difficulty. You cannot just fight something just because it's there, and you need to know as a team, because if one of you dies, you all fail. It's very much a team effort, and that's why I like board games, because they always emphasize on that sense of you are a team and you are working together, and if you ever lose, you lose as a team. All it takes is one of you to fall, and I think sometimes with D&D, especially first to fifth edition, that can get lost because it's a role-playing game and there is really no, you know, if you die with a character, it's like, okay, you have to re-roll a character, but the story continues.
Well, even the concept of death in 5e as a, I don't know, cultural concept for the game is not as popular. I don't know if characters dying is ever a popular thing, but it's almost looked at as a taboo.
I think 5e. It's better. Yeah, definitely. I can see people getting attached to characters, and I've had issues where that's happened before and GMs resurrect them, but I think a good GM makes a death necessary. It doesn't, like, there's people that play as GMs and they make such, their goal seems to be, I want to kill my party. good storytellers and good GMs are ones that let that naturally happen.
Right.
They know when a story should come to an end. And they know when, you know, now's time to really make a sacrifice, or, you know, to have, this is why we have NPCs a lot of the time, so we can convey those stories without action that happening. But eventually you'll get to it, because you're actually working on some of the, you know, anguish spell stuff at the moment. There is a final spell that you can get only if you take a certain class in the Sphere of Anguish book as the Zealot of Anguish, where it's basically, essentially, it's a sixth level spell. You can cast once, and it's designed in a way that will cause permanent, it will cause semi-permanent stat damage, as well as a high amount of damage. Like, if you survive the damage that it's dealt to you, it deals, it can deal quite a lot of stat damage to your wisdom, which, if your wisdom gets reduced, I think it's instant death at a certain point, if it gets to zero or so. Because basically, like, you know, no brain function equals death. Mm-hmm. But the spell is really good. I recommend you have a look at that. It's we were just like, you know what? We're going to give a player a nuke. If they want to go ahead and go out in a blaze of glory, why not give them the tool to go out in a blaze of glory? Like, they themselves, when they cast the spell as well, any creature that's around them could also take damage. So it's like, it could be that, as a storyteller in my mind, let me paint you a picture. You're at the edges of the Grand City. You've gone on all these adventures with your party, and now this big giant bad, which is way beyond, you know, the big bad has awoken this ancient evil, and it's now rising. And you know that you've lost this battle. So you sit there, wind blowing across your face, and almost a nuke-like storm is approaching, you know, as this god pulls itself from the earth beneath. You look at each other, and you look to your zealot mage, and you sort of nod at them, knowing that they've shaped their appearance and they've been growing over time. You know that this is it. You can either stand and fight and lose, or you can run and try and, you know, fight another day. And the rest of you start to leave, and your zealot mage stands at the forefront, a tear down their eye, and they look to you, and they begin to cast the spell. You know what it is, and you know that you have to run. And as you do, the zealot mage dissipates in, you know, this glorified explosion of magic and energy that you've never seen before. And, you know, when the dust settles, nothing is left.
I have to say this, I literally think that this kind of opportunity opens the door for a new subtype of player.
Oh yeah. The martyr.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this was the idea. This is the idea of the Zealot of Anguish. The Zealot of Anguish is very much a class of suffering. It's not a pleasant class to play. Like, for instance, well, because the idea, one of the things on there and the features is that you can have a long rest in a half a period of time, but whenever you're dreaming, it's written in there, whenever you're dreaming, you're not dreaming. You don't go to sleep. You're still awake. So you imagine the long-term effects of someone who's always awake. And although your body is rested, your mind is constantly in agony because you've never truly been able to rest. But, like, they're incredibly wise, they're incredibly intelligent, and they're very charismatic because they've had all this time. Like, you know where they say about the human brain only uses a percentage? The Zealot Anguish has every opportunity to exercise every little thing they can do, but they never have a moment to truly get a break from it. And only in death will they ever be truly at rest.
The way it works, I don't think this is spoilery at all. Correct me if it is. But there are spells that function within the sphere of anguish.
Yes.
And then those that can function outside of it. How does that work with drawing and creating the sphere of anguish? Is that like a demiplane, or is that a...
So the sphere of anguish, and it's all written in the initial bit of lore, is that it was, and it's very common knowledge to be able to find this out, it was made, so it's essentially its own little pocket universe that was created from the death of an ancient god that existed outside of time and space itself. So kind of a little sci-fi to a degree, but very, very fantasy. You know, this god would, you know, time would move very quickly for us, they would move very slowly, and they eventually died. And because of the way that particular being dies, they created a little pocket dimension. But everything about them, all their kind of like, you know, their power, their evils, their you know, everything that every little quality they would have is inside that little bubble. So you get a lot of good and you get a lot of bad, and they are very much a protector of dreams and emotion. And so in their universe, in their dying wishes, they kind of create this universe. And what it does is it's essentially almost like a tumor. It's tethered itself to this plane. And what it does is it creates these kind of little pockets inside that dimension for the souls of people that are like having extreme nightmares and dreams to kind of, you know, be safe in their mind. So they kind of draw, they produce an extreme amount of energy when they do that. And that realm kind of siphons from that energy and uses it to be able to create these little protectional pockets and stabilize the realm. Without that, and without that energy, the, you know, spirits that are trapped there and the demons that linger in that realm would be able to come into ours. And that would cause immense havoc. So it has this almost parasitic relationship with the mortal plane. And this gives a few people that are kind of born between life and death, you know, basically children that are born, you know, some children have this ability where they're connected to the sphere, almost like an umbilical cord to its mother. It usually happens at birth. And I don't think this is a detail that I always put in, but I never wrote because I thought it was a bit too much. And I kind of wanted people to come up with their own way of how the sphere of anguish works. But I always imagine it that, like, you know, children that are kind of born in death are ones that develop a connection to the sphere of anguish because essentially they die before they've ever had a chance to live. Mm-hmm. And so they essentially tether themselves to the sphere of anguish, and that is what brings them to life. It means, though, that they have no connection to the mortal plane in terms of the magic that you have there. So they cannot, as an anguish mage, you cannot cast any spells whatsoever that are not on that list of 100 spells.
Okay.
And you have no affinity for that kind of magic. You will have an affinity for, you know, anguish magic. And the spells that can be cast outside the sphere of anguish are ones that allow you to basically siphon the energy. You know, it's that amount of energy you can siphon through your cord, your connection to the sphere. Whereas there are some spells that you actually have to physically travel there because that connection between you and the sphere, you can't actually physically maintain.
But by traveling there, do you mean, does the caster like open up this sphere when they cast?
No. So imagine, you know, in Doctor Strange, when they go into the other dimension, like say, for instance, they'll be standing somewhere and suddenly the buildings begin to fold and all of a sudden they're in the mirror dimension.
Mm.
You cast a certain area, and that area, basically, anything in it that's human gets teleported to the sphere of anguish. And it almost appears that where you're standing is where you were standing in the mortal realm, because they're essentially, where they're connected together so heavily, it's kind of the same. So you teleport to there, you physically shift yourself. So back in the mortal realm where you are, there's almost like this thin earth-like scar of where you've teleported. And the only way back is through a doorway, which is one of the spells that you have, where basically you cast the spell, and it's almost like I can't remember the name of the spell that inspired it, but it's one where you can create a teleportation to somewhere you can see within a certain distance. You create a dimensional door, that's it. Except with this, you have to imagine a door that you know. So say, for instance, it might be your front door, you know, a cupboard you hidden as a child or something like that, and the caster can then open that door. But once they cast that spell the first time, that is the only door they can use to escape the sphere of anguish. It's almost like if you know you're dreaming and you start to realize you're dreaming, you have control. And if it's a nightmare, you know that you'll imagine something that makes you feel safe. Mm-hmm. So imagining an escape is what you do to get out of the sphere of anguish.
Gotcha. Fascinating.
Interesting.
Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to highlight from DCS, or maybe talk a little bit about the future of what it looks like over there at the Channel Studios?
So definitely the plan is, we did have some other projects in plan this year, but we kind of scrapped a few of those because there's things that make more sense financially and creatively to follow. And there's some things we wanted to do that we realize now need more time to kind of grow before we can redo them. And we need more resources to be able to do them. But we are definitely looking at hopefully within the next few years or so, to develop our own game. There's actually two games in particular that I'd like to do. One of them I'm going to be initially sort of following, which is bridging the gap between role-playing games and tabletop games like Warhammer. So kind of bridging that role-play aspect of Dungeons & Dragons and that freedom to that sort of gameplay focus of Warhammer, where you will... Basically, this is going to be like the official announcement that we're doing this. So it will be a tabletop role-playing game in which you fight for armies. So you create characters that are leaders of armies, and you can play a campaign mode or a standard mode. And you're basically trying to fight in the name of a certain god. And basically, you're fighting to get glory and victory within that god's name. And then at the end of this kind of conquest, that the god that has the most victory will become the, you know, ruler of all gods for a period of time. And basically, you enter an age, kind of in Skyrim, where you get the age of this, the age of that. You essentially enter the age of that god. So there are certain armies that follow certain gods, but they all more or less fight each other, and, you know, it has to be a true battle and true honor and true so on and so forth. But they all fight together and fight against each other, because at the end of the day, although they fight for the same god, sometimes they have disagreements. But you create leaders, you can make your own race, and certain races will have certain benefits. So it's very much the opposite of Warhammer, where sometimes there's a meta of you play a certain race and you have all these advantages, or, and, you know, very little disadvantages, or you have all these disadvantages. This very much is kind of creating a balance where every race has an advantage and a disadvantage. But what makes you different is your war gear and the army that you build. So everyone will have the freedom, each player, an enemy will have the freedom to create these really unique and interesting armies from what they can. When you play in, you know, you're kind of a campaign mode, you start very small and you kind of build up from there, and you all command your own little units and work together to secure objectives and kind of follow a campaign. And then you can play scenario based, where you can actually play the entirety of this game in a versus or kind of one-off scenario. So very much you can play with really high powered leveled armies and have this really big conquest against like this other force, or you can play against PvP. So you can play against actual people, build your own armies, go together and just, you know, go fam. And that's more or less what, you know, I'm trying to create and sort of bring this vision to life. So once we finish with the Zealots of Anguish, I'll be spending a lot of time trying to write and develop and produce that.
It makes me think, is that Blood Rage that has the Ragnarok?
Yes. Yeah, okay. It is.
That makes me think of those eras, except your idea, Lewis, sounds kind of like you get to actually flesh out that era and what it was like under that lead god.
Well, it's always the kind of idea that, you know, when you're fighting a war, there's more than one way to win than just fighting. You very much like, this is where the role-playing aspect will come in your campaign, where you'll have skills. So you could try and sort of negotiate with the enemy to get them to stand down. You know, there's very much ways in which, like, for instance, if you're very much following a god of order and law, you couldn't organize a talk and then try and assassinate your enemy. It will very much be the case that with, when you kind of pick a god and you pick, you know, the faction you're with, you very much want to follow that. And again, the really, really cool part is when you play a campaign, you as a group have to pick factions and races and gods that align. So, like, you know, everyone is good. Everyone is evil, sorry. No one is good. So to a degree, you can argue that each of these four armies kind of join together, you know, for this certain reason, or you can all play as the same sort of faction and army, which is a really cool idea.
Interesting.
Very nice. So yeah, so lots in the works and lots coming up.
Definitely. I think I'm at that point where I've done this for a bit. I'm inspired, I'm ready, and I just want to kind of do the next big thing and really make this a full-time passion.
Well, to that end, maybe as we wrap up here, tell people where they can find you.
So best places you can come and find us is, obviously, you can follow us on Discord, which, you know, we've always got on a link on the, we can always pop a link on in the, we post updates to the Discord here at Adventure Slaying Productions. We have at Twitter at DCSRPG. That's always a good one to go and check us out. Whenever we're doing projects, we post there. We are on Facebook, but most importantly, you can go to www.deadchancestudios.com and you can sign up to a mailing list where you get some free stuff and you'll be sent emails as soon as we launch projects. And we also have a web store there as well that you can go and pick up some of our current stuff for 5th edition D&D, which some of it is designed to be system agnostic. Like, for instance, Caravans, it uses its own little system where for a fantasy game you can create your own little base with its own morale, injury, and upgrade system, which I know you guys have both seen, and that was definitely our biggest and best project, which has kind of inspired me to want to pursue making our own game.
Great. Aaron, do you have any final thoughts?
Nothing really. Caravans was pretty cool, or is pretty cool, I should say. But no, I don't have anything else to add.
All right. Lewis, thanks for joining us today. It's been great to hear what DCS is up to and just sit down and have a chat about all this stuff.
It's been awesome. Thank you for having me.
You bet.